You are listening to Digital Watches Are a Pretty Neat Idea. I am Wabagger, the infinitely prolonged. I've stopped by to say, Brian Dale Campbell, you're a jerk, a complete knee biter.
Hi there, and welcome to Digital Watches Are a Pretty Neat Idea. This is Brian, and I'm with my friend Jeff, and we'll be talking about Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy in all its forms. But before we do that, let's listen to a message from one of our proud sponsors.
This episode of Digital Watches Are a Pretty Neat Idea is brought to you by Jujanta Eyewear. Don't let yourself be stressed out by the dangers of the universe around you. The new Jujanta 200 superchromatic peril-sensitive sunglasses go totally black at the first sign of danger. This protects you from seeing anything that might upset you. Remember, ignorance is bliss with the Jujanta 200 superchromatic peril-sensitive sunglasses. What you can't see won't bother you.
Hey, Brian, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Jeff. How are you?
Well, I feel insulted.
Insulted?
Yeah, some tall, gray-green alien just stepped out of a ship and called me a jerk.
Oh, is that right? You're lucky. Oh, you should have gotten to me first, because apparently my name is before yours in the alphabet, though.
Yes, it is. It is. Maybe he's already insulted you. You just don't know it yet.
He's still out there.
Well, before we start, I want to talk about the bonus episode that we did where we discussed some of the issues that we had with the movie.
All right.
We talked about this earlier, but I wanted to make sure it was brought up on the podcast.
Okay, great.
And of course, this is about Deep Thought being on Magrathea.
Okay.
Your explanation of it not being on Magrathea, but in the other dimension, is what I believe they are trying to convey.
Okay.
But it is not clear.
You're right.
One of the three of them, and I'm going to say Trillian, since a takeoff of Dorothy's line in Wizard of Oz, if she'd have said something like, we're not on Magrathea anymore, that would have been a nice little joke line that might have tied us into the fact that they weren't on Magrathea anymore.
Right, right.
But mostly I want to point out that even if that's what they were going for, the air that they had at the end when the door opened and they were attacked and then there was the flash of light, yes. Zaphod said, it's just a couple of mice. They wouldn't be mice on their home planet. They're only mice in the projection. So
that's correct.
I think they are doing it correct, but they still messed it up.
I think they did.
So now we're going to talk about life, the universe, and everything. And I guess first thing I just want to do is I'm going to ask you, what did you think of the book overall?
That's an interesting question. I think it's quite a bit different than his other books in the series. This one seems to have a, I won't say fully encapsulated, but an encapsulated plot from beginning to end.
Yes.
I don't think it's a story that could be read independently and understood necessarily, but it does bring us to a conclusion by the end of this particular story.
Yes, yes, it does.
So in that case, it's a bit different.
It's, yes. I guess the way I think about it is that the first two were things that were happening to our core group of characters, where this one is there's a problem that they're trying to solve.
Correct.
So they're not just falling into all of these messes. They're actively going out and getting into all these messes.
Or let's just say that the universe has decided that it is important for them to actively get involved and mess up everything.
Yes. Yes, it does.
Part 1. Arthur Dent wakes up screaming, as he always does, realizing he is stranded on prehistoric Earth. he reflects back on how rotten of a time he has had. One rainy night, he decides to make a carry-all pouch out of a rabbit skin. He uses the pouch to swat a fly. He then announces that he is going to go mad. Ford picked up a space-time anomaly on his sensors. He comes back and meets Arthur at his cave and explains how he was wandering the globe and spent some time in Africa. 20 minutes after Arthur had decided he would go mad, he was chasing a Chesterfield sofa across the fields of prehistoric Earth. Arthur and Ford catch the sofa. They materialize on Lord's cricket ground just in front of a gentleman, giving him a heart attack. Arthur could not believe he had finally made it home. He is back to the Earth and the England he knows and loves, only to discover it was 2 days before the Earth is to be destroyed. A batted ball from the cricket match improbably landed in Arthur's bag. He did not tell anybody. Arthur and Ford meet back up with Slarty Bartfast, who has a ship that resembles a small French bistro. He has come to this cricket match to retrieve a trophy consisting of the ashes from a wooden cricket stump. Slarty Bartfast did not get them in time. The ashes were taken by 11 white robots.
So I'm going to just start right out and talk about some of the things that I enjoyed in this book. Like the fact that Arthur wakes up every morning screaming in horror, realizing where he is. I like that he's not gotten used to it.
No, that's fantastic.
I'm surprised that restaurant ended with he and Ford hooking up with two girls, Agda and Mella.
Mm-hmm.
We can guess that Agda was the girl who drank the water that was fouled by the dead fox.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because they talk about the girlfriend that he lost. No idea what happened to Mella. Loonies or not, it has to be better than spending it alone.
I would think so, but I also know that most of the people who get to know Arthur don't really want to hang around him too much.
Yeah, you're right, because he and Ford had parted ways, and Ford was gone for 4 years.
That's right. That's right. In this story, they do part ways, and they, I don't know why Arthur's alone in his cave.
Screaming when he wakes up.
I know why he's screaming when he wakes up, I just don't know why he's alone when he does it.
So for those who might not have understood the beginning, there is a character named Wowbagger the Infinitely Prolonged, and it is his mission to insult everybody in the universe in alphabetical order, and he could have handled being an immortal, not being born that way, but the Sunday afternoons. If it wasn't for the Sunday afternoons, that just, for whatever reason, there's something about Sunday afternoons that get to me, too. It's like everything's fine, but Sunday afternoon is just a rough spot to get through.
Yes, that's where the famous line that gets repeated later is spoken, and that's the long, dark tea time of the soul.
Yes, yes. That is definitely Sunday afternoon.
But I do like here at the beginning, they talk about, he says that Arthur has been lost in space and in time.
Yes.
And that the good thing about being lost in space is that it keeps you busy.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. He's a little bit bored on Earth with nobody to talk to.
That's right. That's right. And I also think that Adams's description of the gray-green races having to, in order to have the nice complexion, they have to get plenty of exercise and use very expensive soap.
Yes, that's right. I want to contradict something that Arthur says because I disagree with his assessment.
Okay.
So this is after Ford returns and becomes immediately annoying.
Mm-hmm.
He and Arthur are having a conversation.
Right.
We know that according to Restaurant at the End of the Universe, when the ship crash landed, it says that countless numbers had been lost to the swamp in the night.
Yes.
And millions more had been sucked down with the ship.
Right.
But those that survived still numbered hundreds of thousands.
Mm-hmm.
We also know that the letter Q, Arthur hurled into a bush, it hit the rabbit that ran away, eaten by a fox, choked on its bone, died in the bank of a stream, that killed the girl that Ford mm-hmm. struck up a relationship with.
Right.
We know there had to be more people that died from that too. Couldn't have been just her.
Yep.
At the beginning of this book, when Ford asked Arthur what happened to the Golgafrinchians, Arthur said, a lot of them didn't make it through the winter 3 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and the few who remained in the spring said they needed a holiday and set off on a raft. Not rafts, a single raft. Here's what Arthur says.
Okay.
He says, history says they must have survived. I say, no. History says they're dead too, and the original Earth population repopulated now that they're all gone. So I don't think Arthur's corrupt. I do not think Arthur has been descended from Golgafrinchum. I think he is an original product of Earth.
Okay. I don't know how to counter that. Let me see.
You're not supposed to counter it. You're supposed to agree wholeheartedly.
Oh, okay. I see. I agree wholeheartedly.
So you disagree. You think that the few that set off on a raft survived and repopulated the planet, and that every single prehistoric human died off.
Well, how about this? It was supposedly just two of them at the beginning.
Well,
Adam and Eve, you remember those two?
Yeah.
So if even two of them existed after this raft trip, then they could repopulate the world. You know, I'm just being facetious. The other thing is, I think that the description that Arthur gives is an exaggeration of what went on there. As you say, there was hundreds of thousands of them, so one raft is certainly not going to be enough to get them all out of there. And presumably, as soon as they...
No, that's because they all died during the winter. They all died three winters ago.
You said most of them. I guess that's true.
Only a few remained. Few. Few. Not hundreds of thousands or many. Few who remained. So I'm saying the Golgafrinchians are gone, not part of our history. But that's just me.
Okay.
All right. I like to point out all these little insights just to have you crush them.
Well, I don't want to crush everything, you know. It's just they're being supercilious. I mean, they're over-exaggerating the nature of what was going on there, you know.
Yes. There are a couple of jokes that he likes to put in there that I really wasn't a fan of.
Okay.
Biggest one was the misunderstanding of Eddie's in the space-time continuum. And Arthur kept going, who's Eddie? And all I kept wanting to say is, he's the shipboard computer on the Heart of Gold. How do you not know who Eddie is?
Okay, I see. So the problem with this particular joke is it's far too close to a pun for you to appreciate.
No. I can understand him misunderstanding a person's name for a whirlpool,
mm-hmm.
but him saying or asking who's Eddie when we've just spent two books with Eddie didn't make sense.
Okay, yep.
Anyway, that was just me. And I also was not a fan of the Chesterfield sofa just appearing out of nowhere at first until I came across my favorite passage in the entire book.
Okay.
Which is, only 20 minutes ago, he had decided he would go mad. And now he was already chasing a Chesterfield sofa across the fields of prehistoric Earth. So Arthur had made the comment that he was going to go mad. And then 20 minutes later, he thought, it has happened.
Okay, so That brings up a good question, and I don't know if we're prepared to answer this at this point or whether you want me to wait until way later in the story. Shall I bring it up now?
Well, let's preview it here, and if we need to answer it later.
Okay. So there are two things that happen in this story, or at this point in the story, that you've raised objections to, and one being the sofa, the other one being the joke about eddies in the space-time continuum. Those two things actually reoccur almost in their exact nature at the end of the book.
Yes.
And I am going to suggest here that the sofa is actually a creation of Hektar. And that is why when they are seated on that sofa at the end of the book,
yes,
they can physically sit on it, because it's one of the few things that Hektar actually created.
I will agree with that. And the joke about the eddies in the space-time continuum, I was just not happy with the way it was presented. The joke didn't make sense with Arthur not knowing who Eddie was. That was my objection. I just think it should have been done a different way. The Chesterfield sofa, yes, that comes back at the end.
So at this point, after Ford returns to Arthur, they have a conversation about what it is to go mad. And Ford explains that his madness was to become a lemon,
yes,
for a while and jump in and out of a gin and tonic.
Right.
Which, when Arthur asks, well, where did he find a gin and tonic? Ford says, well, I found a lake that thought it was a gin and tonic. Or at least I think I thought it was a gin and tonic.
Right, yes.
And I just love the circular reference to the gin and tonics coming back and again and again.
Yes, yes.
And then Ford goes on to say that he went to Africa and that he then became singularly responsible for the evolved shape of the animal that Arthur would come to know as a giraffe.
Right, right. Which only makes me wonder, what could he have possibly done?
Exactly.
There are a whole ton of brand new concepts that he adds into this book. And one of my favorites is the SEP, or the somebody else's problem. I have something similar that I refer to all the time, and I call it objective blindness, mm-hmm, which is the object that you are looking for, you cannot see. And I have had many stories of things that were right in front of me that only appear once somebody actually points them out.
Well, see, that always happens to me 30 minutes into the hardware store, where I've gone up and down every single aisle, looked at every single thing in the aisle, then finally stop someone and say, where's the... And they point to the shelf that I'm standing next to.
Right. So, yeah, we've all been there.
Well, that's where those pockets of space-time, you know, it wasn't there 10 minutes ago when I looked at it, but it was there now.
So Ford and Arthur are together. The Chesterfield sofa appears. They catch the sofa and poof, they land on Lord Cricket Grounds, and they are on what we would consider modern day Earth. And they meet up with Slarty Bartfast again.
Yes, yes, yes. And this is one of those moments where I just enjoy so much and I think we've discussed this to some extent before, but again, you and I are listening to the book and reading the book at the same time, listening with a version from Adams, and of course, reading the book as it's presented on paper or in digital format.
Right.
And this is one of the ones where he just sneaks it right in there and it would blow right past you. I don't know if you caught this one or not. He says that he leapt to his feet like an author hearing the phone ring.
No, I didn't. I did not catch that.
And you know all the stress he had going through, you know, the other book and the timelines and the deadlines and right, all that kind of stuff. And that, of course, is only in the recording. It's not actually written in the book. But I thought that was a great line.
Yes, it was. So another great line. I'm going to jump ahead a little bit. So Slurry Bartfast is at the Lord Cricket Ground to retrieve this trophy, which contains the ashes of a wooden stump. And he's just going to go get it. So the book says that he was marching out onto the pitch with terrible purpose in his gait, his hair, beard, and robes swept behind him, looking very much as Moses would have looked if Sinai had been a well-cut lawn instead of, as it is usually more represented, a fiery smoking mountain. So that's another line that when it went by, it just cracked me up. And then he's got the whole second part of it. The robots come and they start blowing up and attacking the place, and they get the urn with the ashes before Slarty Bartfast does. Then he says, out of the drifting smoke emerged the pale figure of Slarty Bartfast, looking even more like Moses, because in spite of the continued absence of the mountain, he was now at least striding across a fiery and smoking, well-mown lawn. So the imagery that I got out of that whole passage was worth reading the book.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, that was funny. And I do love the little, again, these little echoes that go on in this story. Of course, at one point during the scene, the cricket ball falls into Arthur's hands and it's in his bag, I guess.
Yes.
It falls into his bag.
Yes.
And then a young boy comes running over looking for the ball. And the young boy absolutely positively repeats Wow Banger's insult to the word for word about Arthur.
Yes. Yes, he does. Well, and Arthur, when the ball fell in his bag, he immediately like pretends that it didn't, and he starts looking around on the ground. So Slarty Bartfast has his own ship now that he didn't have last time, and I guess I want you to talk about the ship.
Okay. So the ship looks like an Italian bistro. It is fueled by what is referred to as bistromathics.
Right.
Which, again, they use a similar concept in that there are irrational or illogical numbers that are used to move the ship around space. And those illogical and irrational numbers can exist in a certain number of places. And, of course, one of them is on the receipt or invoice given to you from a bistro where
Correct.
Nothing can be determined and it's an irrational concept.
Right. They like to call them non-absolute numbers.
Correct.
There's three that they talk about. And the first one being the number of people for who the table is reserved.
Yes.
But my favorite of the non-absolute numbers is the given time of arrival.
Yes.
Which is now known to be one of those most bizarre of mathematical concepts. Let's see if I can read this. reverse seclusion. It's a number whose existence can only be defined as being anything other than itself. In other words, the given time of arrival is the one moment of time at which it is impossible that any member of the party will arrive. Yes. So it's so absolutely true. So can you, he reads it great in his audio, but he wrote it.
Yes, he does. And I wrote down that same thing, but there's no way that I could repeat.
Recip reverse seclusions.
Yep. Recip reverse seclusions. What a weird word. I mean, it's fantastic.
Yeah. Take four different words.
And it's here in the book where Adams has added some additional information into his reading of the book. We're given the second fact that has existed since the beginning of the universe. And I think, Jeff, you said you had that written down?
Well, gotta tell them the first one.
Oh, gosh. Hold on. I don't have it. I don't have it in front of me. Let me get there. Important fact from Galactic History Number 1. Reproduced from the Sidereal Daily Mentioner's Book of Popular Galactic History. The night sky above the planet Cricket is the least interesting sight in the entire universe.
And remember, that's an important fact. Important fact number 2 is, since this galaxy began, vast civilizations have risen and fallen, risen and fallen, risen and fallen, so often that it's quite tempting to think that life in this galaxy must be A, something akin to seasick, spacesick, timesick, history sick, or some such thing, and B, stupid.
And I love that line. And I wonder, I mean, I know Adams obviously felt it was important because in his reading of the book, he adds it back into the story. But as we discussed before, this is an area where it's not actually in the written material of the book itself.
Right, right.
Part two. Marvin was rescued by a scrap metal merchant who fixed him up with an artificial leg. Through a series of events, he has been stranded on a planet full of sentient mattresses, all of which are named Zem. He has been walking in a small circle for millions of years. A team of white robots appeared, took Marvin's artificial leg, and left. Moments later, they came back and took Marvin. Zaphod, having completed the mission he was trying to avoid, is drunk and depressed. Trillian, being tired of his behavior, teleported away without setting coordinates. With Trillian gone, Zaphod was stomping around and a spaceship materialized through the bridge of the Heart of Gold. A group of white robots was there to take the golden infinite improbability drive, the literal Heart of Gold. The planet Cricket was a planet surrounded by a huge dust cloud. Because of the dust cloud, the night sky was totally black and starless. The people of Cricket did not know there was a rest of the universe. Then one day, the burning wreckage of a spaceship came out of the sky and crashed on the planet's surface. They stripped every secret out of the wreckage of that burnt-up spaceship and then built their own ship in 1 year. The initial launch of the ship, Cricket 1, took them through and out of the dust cloud. Upon seeing the galaxy and the rest of the universe, they turned around and said, "It'll have to go," and decided to destroy it. The Great Cricket War lasted 2,000 years. After the war, the planet of Cricket was to be locked in an envelope of slow time until the rest of the universe came to its final end. All light would be deflected so that it would remain invisible. The lock would be on an asteroid, which would slowly orbit the envelope. The key would be the symbol of the galaxy, the Wicket Gate. The key consisted of a wooden pillar, a perspex pillar, a steel pillar, a silver bale, and a gold bale. Unfortunately, after the envelope was locked, a Cricket warship, which had been missing, presumed destroyed, turned out to be just missing.
So then the book cuts away, and we get to hear a very brief explanation of what happened to Marvin. There's no detail, and it seems just to be put there to find some way to work Marvin back into the story in an important way.
Yes. What an odd chapter.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. There were a couple of chuckles. The walking in a circle bit was good because he's got a bad leg and only one leg works. And so he can only walk in a circle. And I want to do this to somebody, and I might do it this weekend at my niece's graduation party. To prove that he was more intelligent than the mattresses, he says, "Think of a number, any number." And the mattress says, "5. And he says, "Wrong."
Oh, gosh. But here again, don't you love Adams? And I know you love this part about him, too, because here again, he uses one of his favorite little go-to jokes. And he says, "The swamp trees were gray with it and the tall reeds indistinct. It hung motionless like held breath. Nothing moved. There was silence. The sun struggled feebly through the mist, tried to impart a little warmth here, shed a little light there, but clearly today was going to be just another long haul across the sky. Nothing moved. Again, silence. Nothing moved. Silence. Nothing moved."
Yeah. Not even the story.
In the story, I mean, this chapter was so funny when I was listening and reading, and I'm like, "What the heck can you say about this chapter?"
Right, right. Well,
Nothing moved, even the story.
He's bringing back the mattresses, which he talked about in a previous book.
Uh-huh.
Because in an infinite universe, everything's mm-hmm. going to exist.
He even mentions that in the infinite universe, there's places where ratchets, screwdrivers, hang like fruit from trees.
Right, that's right. So the mattress planet, I didn't write the name of it. It's Squanchulus, I don't even...
Squanchulus Zeta.
Squanchulus yes. Zeta.
Squanchulus Zeta.
Is a planet full of sentient mattresses, and they're all named Zem.
I do like that little joke.
Yes, that is definitely good. Wonder if it was taken from the Monty Python sketch where everybody was named Bruce.
Yes, it could very well be.
I believe he did write for them.
Oh, yeah, he probably did. The other thing I did like about this particular chapter is his use of onomatopoetic words. He just goes over and over himself trying to come up with words like flolloped.
Yes.
And glumped.
Right. Yeah. In a flolloppy manner.
Yes.
And the thing is, it's a word you've only read in this book, and you know exactly what it means.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, while Marvin is walking in a circle, talking with the mattresses and proving how much more intelligent he is, robots show up and take his bad leg, and then they go back and they take the rest of them.
Yep.
And then Marvin's gone for quite a while.
Yes, he is.
So this book does follow some patterns that the other books have set. So Slarty Bartfast needs to explain to Arthur the Cricket Wars. So now there's a recording again that explains what the Cricket Wars were. But my favorite part about this is that when it starts, Slarty Bartfast is saying, just don't buy anything. And then he tells Arthur, don't nod your head, don't nod your head. And then the man in the recording says, now let us bow our heads in payment.
Yeah, that was a good one.
Just going to sneak that in there. Oh, no, everybody bowed.
Yeah, I also like his use of the simile, you know. He repeatedly uses similes to describe the emotional depth of what's happening during this entire sequence. For instance, he says, it was impersonal. Not like a randomly flung fist in a crowd is impersonal, but like a computer-assisted parking summons is impersonal. And it was deadly, again, not like a bullet or a knife is deadly, but like a brick wall across an expressway is deadly.
Oh, yeah. That just paints a picture. Mm-hmm. It paints a picture. So in the recording, the planet Cricket is explained. And it's explained as an idyllic, serene planet with a starless night sky. Hence, I guess, why it's the least interesting sky in the universe. And then one day, the hulk of a spaceship crash-landed on the planet and caused them to build their own spaceship, Cricket One. It is revered the greatest feat in space travel history because it only took a year to build. And while talking about the other great feats of spaceship engineering, they mention the starship Titanic.
I love it.
This must be where it was born.
Must be. And they tell the story of the starship Titanic, which I thought was great.
Yes. This is a passage that he uses here talking about the launching of the starship Titanic, that it was conclusively proven that more people watched the Tri-D coverage of the launch than actually existed at the time. So there are a lot of things like that. I can't think of an example in our world right now, but
mm-hmm.
a lot of times people's memory of hearing a story about it
right.
transitions into them thinking they actually experienced it.
Yeah, this is true. And it's funny because I was thinking to myself, I was sort of reading this book of, I don't know, have you ever played cricket?
I have not. Yes, kind of once.
I played cricket once as well. And I found the game to be, as he puts it, generally generally regarded as incomprehensibly dull and a painful, pointless game.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. I just didn't get it. I really didn't.
No, I didn't either.
It's also in this area of the book where they talk about the concept of learning how to fly by throwing yourself at the ground and then missing.
Yes, that's...
Hopefully by getting distracted enough so that you don't actually hit the ground.
Right, right. That's, I think, my favorite concept in any of his books ever was learning to fly. And after they talk about how to fly, they say that Cricket 1 was built, flew through the dust cloud, and they saw for the first time that there was a rest of the universe.
Right.
And unable to cope with the idea, they decided to obliterate and get rid of it.
Right.
And that started the Cricket War that went on for 2,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
After the war ended, the planet was locked in an envelope of slow time, and the key was a wicket gate. After the envelope was locked, a Cricket warship, which had been missing, presumed destroyed, turned out just to be missing. So it was like, ooh, there's one left. It's always the way. All the entire Cricket world was put back on Cricket, except for one.
One ship, yep.
And the game of Cricket seems to share a parallel with the word Belgium, meaning that the people of Earth are so primitive we don't understand the implications.
Yep. Yeah, that's where it's repeated. It does say again here at this part of the story, it says eddies in the space-time continuum. That is where the pieces of the original Wicket Gate exist, somewhere in the eddies in the space-time continuum.
Yes. The problem with some of his things that he has written is you can't, and this is the problem that the movie ran into, is that you can't abridge them and have them make sense.
Mm-hmm.
Like if I want to talk about the campaign for real time, I almost have to read the three paragraphs about the campaign for real time to make it make sense.
If that's what we got to do, that's what we should do, right? Whatever you think you need to do. You want to read it?
I think I can summarize these. It's going to be disjointed, and hopefully it'll make sense, but we'll figure it out. There's a group called the Campaign for Real Time who are really trying to stop time travel from happening because of all of the problems that it causes. And one of the examples that they use was a poet, Lalifa, who wrote the finest poems in existence about a girl who had left him. And he told all of his agonies about that. And not only that, but he wrote them on pages of dried habra leaves without the benefit of correcting fluid. So after the invention of time travel, some major correcting fluid manufacturers wondered whether his poems might have been better still if he had access to correcting fluid, and whether he could be persuaded to say a few words about it. So they went back in time, and he did all that, and he became very rich. And after he got rich, the girl who he wrote the poems about who left him didn't leave him. And so he never got around to writing the poems in the first place.
Yep. And then they sent him to a planet on his own for a while, so that he could transcribe the version that they had on file.
Right. Yeah.
With corrections.
Yeah. Right. Do you have stuff about Lalifa?
No. Well, the only thing I had was a glass of perspective and soda.
Right.
Which I thought was a funny line.
And then there was a great cathedral of Chalicum. Mm-hmm. Or Chalicum that was pulled down in order to build an ion refinery. But the construction of the refinery had taken so long, and it had to extend so far back into the past to allow production to start on time, that the cathedral was never built in the first place.
Right. Right.
So it's like trying to wrap your mind around some of that gets to be tricky, but
yeah,
man,
yeah,
it's
yeah. That's why I prefer the concept of the multiverse, you know?
Right.
And we've talked a little bit about time travel and that kind of thing. And it's so silly. I was listening the other day to a program and they were talking about the wonders of the universe or whatever. And it's remarkable when you realize that, of course, that the Earth is traveling so quickly through space and the sun is traveling through space. The sun is moving and the Earth is moving,
right?
Not just spinning, but moving through space.
Right.
So if you were really literally going to go back in time, you would have to physically go back into some location where nothing actually currently exists. And it just, for me, it's not just physical, but literal impossibility.
Right.
You know, even if you could warp space, you'd have to warp it in a way that is just mind-bogglingly difficult.
Yeah. That's why all the time travel stories are disappointing at the best.
Yes. Yes, I agree. I agree. But this one's a time travel story, too.
Yes, yes it is. And then I have, I hate puns, and the pun that Douglas Adams put into this book. So do you want to do that bad pun?
Which pun are you referring to?
The disconnected story about the guide being taken over by Megadodo Publications. And Lig Lurie Jr.
Oh, yeah, I wrote that one down. You didn't like that, huh?
I am not a fan of them. So if you would like to, I've got the whole thing written here to read it. Or if you would like to read it, you can read it. The thing about puns that bother me the most is the length of time or the length of the setup.
Right.
The one that you said about, I call my girl Hinge. That's short. Usually, it's 15 minutes of something that all leads to that.
Right. So what we're talking about here is the Adams is fitting in a pun just to annoy Jeff.
Yes. Yes, he did.
Where one of the, is it the president or the operating officer of the Hitchhiker's Guide going out for lunch and never returning. And now there is a sign that says missing, presumed fed.
Right. Right.
Oh, man.
Part 3. During another teleportation, Arthur was diverted away from his group to a damp, dark place. It was the Cathedral of Hate. The Cathedral of Hate was constructed by Aggersag in memory of those who had fallen to Arthur Dent. Arthur has been responsible for the death of Aggersag in all of his previous lives, including a fly, a rabbit, a gentleman at a cricket match, and a bowl of petunias. The cathedral also contained a hideous 50-foot statue of Arthur. Aggersag, now a mad fat bat, was in his last life. He was going to use it to kill Arthur. During his tirade, Aggersag mentioned the time Arthur killed him on Stravomula Beta. Arthur, having never been there, was brought to the cathedral too soon and was able to escape. During his escape, Arthur was caught in a landslide, tripped, and fell. He was distracted by seeing a bag he lost 10 years ago and missed the ground. He was flying. Arthur flew up into the clouds and crashed a party, literally. The rest of the group was already at the party looking for the Silver Bail. The Silver Bail was now a Rory Award for the most gratuitous use of the word Belgium in a serious screenplay. The cricket robots whooped into the party and stole it. After that, the party came to an end. As the group was trying to leave, Trillian was with Thor, who did not want her to go. Arthur was able to get her to leave with him. The Cricket robots now have all the pieces of the key. Slartabartfast, Arthur, Trillian, and Ford watched as the Cricket robots unlocked the lock on the asteroid orbiting Cricket, and then the group went down to the planet's surface. Zaphod, alone on the Heart of Gold, typed some of his game score numbers into the infinite improbability drive and appeared in the robot war zones many miles above the surface of the planet of Cricket. Marvin had been harnessed to the central intelligence core of the Cricket War computer. The Cricket robots, which had salvaged him, had recognized his gigantic intelligence. However, it only depressed all the war robots.
So now we get to talk about Agrajag.
Agrajag.
And we get to learn all about Agrajag and the Cathedral of Hate.
Yes, Infinite Umbrage. So Arthur is in the cave, and the first thing he sees is a neon sign. It's just funny to me because it says that he thinks that the neon sign is shouting out its words in a contemptuous flourish.
Right, right.
But he doesn't understand how neon can be contemptuous.
Right. What does the sign say?
And the sign said, "You have been diverted."
I wanted to make this a shirt just to see if anybody would understand it.
Oh, there you go. Right.
Right. So he's been taken from the rest of the group.
Then, of course, he hears what he thinks is the beating of a brass drum. And in that cathedral, we see the statue that Agrajag has commissioned.
Right.
Of Arthur. With his multiple arms doing nasty things to Agrajag's previous lives.
So Agrajag is this being who has been reincarnated over and over and over and over. And every one of his incarnations, he has been killed in some direct or indirect way by Arthur. Arthur.
Yes, absolutely. And one of his hands, Arthur can't quite identify what the one hand is presumably doing. And later in talking with Agrajag, he determines that this hand is supposedly bringing into existence the bowl of petunias.
Right.
And of course, that would be a concept that would not easily leap to mind as you see someone's hand gesture.
Right. So the Bowl of Petunias and Oh No, Not Again was Agrajag because he saw Arthur in the window of the Heart of Gold as he plummeted to the ground.
That's right. That's right. And of course, in the end, well, are we going to talk about the end of Agrajag here?
Sure.
So in the end, Agrajag is discussing with Arthur all the methods and all the ways that he's been killed by Arthur. And Agrajag learns that in one of his deaths, Arthur has not yet been.
Correct.
So Arthur has arrived at the cave prior to one of Agrajag's final lives.
Right.
So he's stuck in a time loop. And of course, you know the inevitable. Agrajag will die as Arthur jumps on him from the statue.
Yes.
Just as Agrajag manages to push the button that will blow up the cave. One of Arthur's favorite things in life to do is avoid being blown up.
Right, right.
Where he runs out of the cave, and as he's running out of the cave, assuming that he's going to die, he trips, and as he's going towards the ground, he sees a bag that he left at the airport, and suddenly he's flying.
Yes, yes. And then all of the things going through his mind about that was perfect. It's kind of exactly what would go through your mind. I can't think about it. Can I pick up a bag? How would I do it? Oh, it was brilliant.
Yeah, and I do like the description. He says he felt the way he imagined an angel might feel, doing a celebrated dance on the head of a pin while being counted by philosophers.
Right, right.
And that was his response to flying.
So as he's flying, he's going up and up and up and up, and he literally crashes into a party. So there is a party floating up in the air somewhere, and it is a party that's been going on for four generations. And the rest of the group is there.
How convenient.
How convenient. During this part, he does throw in this one line that I thought was perfect. So I guess Arthur has crashed into this party, and wherever he touched himself, he encountered a pain. Mm-hmm. After a short while, he worked out that it was because it was his hand that was hurting.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
We didn't talk about this much at the beginning, but this is so much different than a normal or the first two Hitchhiker's books, which is everything's not a joke here. There's so much story that you have to pay attention to. It's a more complicated story, not just a simple thing as a catalyst for jokes. But right. Man, when he writes in the jokes, they're worth it.
Okay. Yes, you're absolutely correct.
So as I'm going through this book, all of a sudden, I was so happy that we stumbled on that little lost interview called Sheila's Ear.
Right.
Because when I read this line from Slarty Bartfast as he was chatting up a partygoer, one of the interesting things about space is how dull it is. You see? There's so much of it.
Yes.
And so little in it.
Oh, yes.
I'm like, I know that line. I know where that line came from.
Oh, gosh. You know, until you repeated it.
He found a way.
Yes, he did find a way. That's fantastic.
Because that's the best line in the whole Sheila's Ear thing.
Right.
And he found a way to work it into one of his books. So yep. I was very happy.
Right, right.
Here we get a little preview, and he goes off on a seemingly unconnected story or a tangent about this insanely aggressive race of people called the Silastic Armor Fiends of Stridorax. And what I liked about it is he pointed out that the Silastic Armor Fiends of Stridorax was just the name of their race.
Right.
The name of their army was something quite horrific.
Yeah, I love that.
And it's like, fill in your own name here. It's like, yeah. I'm not going to give you a name. You can just imagine one.
All right. Blood. Blood. Blood.
Blood. Yeah. Yes. That works here. So once again, on this party where everybody is now together again, the cricket robots arrive and they get what they need and they leave. What they got at the party was something called a Rory. Do you remember what the Rory was?
Yes, it was an award that was received by an actor who's attending the party.
Correct. And what did he get the award for?
Well, it depends on if you're listening to the story or actually reading the book. Again, I don't know whether you caught this one or not.
Does it say something different in the book?
It's not the same. When Douglas Adams reads it to us, he uses a four-letter word that sounds like truck.
Right.
Over and over again. He says that that's what receives the award for, Rory, is to use that word in a most gratuitous fashion.
Yes.
But in the book, it's our favorite word, Belgium.
No, I didn't see that in the book. But it's
yes.
Perfect.
Yes, and it goes on to describe, again, how ignorant the human race is, and they don't understand how vulgar and disgusting the word Belgium is, and that the only place that it's appropriate to use it is in a screenplay with the gratuitous use of the word Belgium. And I just laughed and laughed as I was looking at that. And to me, I don't know why Adams would choose to use the other word, because it's far funnier to use Belgium, I think.
What edition? Is it an early edition that has Belgium? I'm amazed at how many different editions and how many little changes have been made in these books. In a way, it's kind of disappointing.
I'm reading from the first edition hardcover that I got in 84.
Okay. And it says Belgium.
I didn't read it from the Ultimate Guide that we are also reading it from. And it says Belgium. Yep.
So Belgium is apparently the original version.
I would think so. Yep. Because do you know when the recording is? When the recording was made that we're listening to?
I don't know, but the PDF I have has the F word in it.
Doesn't matter, I guess. I was just curious.
No, that's... Belgium is so much funnier, and it always kind of weirded me out that the PDF that I have of Life, the Universe, and Everything has the most gratuitous use of the word, and they use the F word in there.
Well, you know, especially since, I was thinking about that. We've commented about other shows that rip them off and such, but I don't know if you remember the South Park episode.
Which one?
The South Park episode where they use foul language and there's a counter on the screen that shows how many times they say
right,
a nasty word.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah.
It just... It just makes me laugh. But I think, as you just said, the use of Belgium is so much funnier than, you know, the F word, as it were.
It is. It is.
There's a couple of other... There's one other occasion earlier in the book where my version, my 84 hardcover version, is different than the reading. We don't need to go into it, but it's back in the part where it was talking about Bistromathics. There's four pages, essentially, in the book that were edited by... Adams in his reading that talk about how the Bistromathic drive unit is designed and set up and how the waiters interact with each other and how that creates the propulsion that moves the ship into, you know, improbable distances and that kind of thing. Interesting. It talks here about Slarty Varpfast. He was planning on retiring and writing a book on fjords.
Oh,
that's another part that's not in the story, not in the audio part.
No, I don't remember that in the audio.
Yeah, it's not in the audio version. Here's a little fact about the Brockian Ultra Cricket. I did think it was funny when they mentioned that the rules for the Brockian Ultra Cricket were so complicated that when they were finally compiled in one place that it was so... dense that it caused a black hole to be created.
Right. Yes.
And ultimately that the winning team shall be the first team that wins.
Right. Okay, so the cricket robots have taken the award, which is a silver bale.
Yep.
And the group splits up. Slarty Barfast and Arthur and Ford and Trillian are going to follow them, but Zaphod apparently wants nothing to do with this anymore and has been sent back to the Heart of Gold.
Right.
And he's all alone on the Heart of Gold, and he's really bored.
Right.
So he's just playing a couple of video games, and he took his high score and his current score and typed them into the infinite improbability drive just to see where it would go, and bingo! He got right back with the group.
Yep, we're still stuck in that improbability loop, aren't we?
Yes, we are.
Part 4. The Celastic Armor Fiends of Striterax ordered the supercomputer Hakdar to design an ultimate weapon. Hakdar designed the supernova bomb. It was the size of a small ball. Since Hakdar knew there was nothing that could be worse than the known consequence of setting the bomb off, he took the liberty of introducing flaw into the design. Hakdar explained this to them, and he was pulverized. Trillian figured out that the dust cloud was the pulverized supercomputer Hakdar. His revenge for being pulverized was to create a full-scale model of a spaceship and crash it on Cricket. He knew the series of events that would follow. He also gave them the design for the ultimate weapon. She and Arthur confronted Hakdar in the dust cloud about why he wants to destroy the universe. Hakdar explained it was for revenge and to fulfill his function. He also admitted he could build real things. Hakdar was then dispersed to destroy his consciousness. Arthur and Ford went back in time a day or two to Lord's Cricket Ground to return the stolen ashes. It was still in chaos. Arthur was bumped and dropped and spilled the ashes on the ground. As they were leaving, Arthur noticed a wicket gate was still left standing. He was determined to bowl once at Lord's Cricket Ground. He remembered the small red cricket ball was still in his bag. As he ran, noticed the ball was emitting a deep red glow and flashing intermittently. He saw that standing at the wicket was a cricket robot. He could not stop himself. He tripped over his bag that he left on the ground. He fell. He missed the ground. He soared up into the air and hurled the bomb harmlessly off into the distance. He swooped down, wrestled the battle club from the robot, and knocked the robot's head from the robot's shoulders.
So what I found strange at this part of the book is that Trillian is pretty much a non-existent person. And all of a sudden, she's become the most important person in the book.
Yes.
Because she has figured out that Hakdar has been pulverized and is the dust cloud surrounding Cricket. And not only did he build the spaceship and crash it into the planet to cause them to become xenophobic and want to kill everything.
Right.
He also gave them the design for the very small supernova bomb.
Right, right.
And so this is where she and Arthur confront Hakdar in the dust cloud mm-hmm. and where they sit on the Chesterfield sofa
right.
that we mentioned right. in the beginning.
Right.
And they have a long discussion with Hakdar and...
Hakdar and Arthur, yeah.
Yeah, she and Arthur are having a long conversation with Hakdar
yep.
about why he wants to destroy the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And he confesses to everything. And he admitted that he could build real things, which is why they're sitting on the sofa. He was being dispersed by a vibration field. Ford and Trillian heard him say, "What is done is done.
Right.
I have fulfilled my function." So that's kind of ominous.
Yes, it is.
So Arthur and Ford go back a day or two in time to Lord's Cricket Ground to return the stolen ashes. And everything was still in chaos. Arthur was bumped and dropped and spilled the ashes on the ground.
Right.
And as they were leaving, Arthur noticed that there was a wicket gate still standing, and he was mm-hmm. determined that he was going to bowl once at Lord Cricket Ground.
Right. Right.
And then he remembers he's got this small red ball in his bag. But earlier, something changed. He noticed something, and that small red cricket ball was replaced. And
right.
it was emitting a deep red glow mm-hmm. and flashing. And as he's going to bowl at the cricket wicket, he sees a cricket robot.
Right.
And he could not stop himself. Mm-hmm. And we all know that feeling of being too far into emotion to stop it.
That's right.
And as he ran, he tripped over his bag that he left on the ground and he fell. But mm-hmm. he missed the ground. And he soared up in the air and hurled the bomb harmlessly off into the distance.
Right.
And then he swooped down and wrestled the battle club from the robot and knocked the robot's head from the robot's shoulders. So Arthur becomes a barbarian.
Oh, yes. But see, this is where it all comes full circle. Of course, on his first trip to the Lord's Cricket Ground, he's carrying the rabbit skin bag, and the rabbit skin bag is what the cricket ball falls into.
Right.
And of course, throughout the story, his bag changes and changes again and changes again.
Correct.
And it becomes the missing piece of luggage or tote-all, that's what the British call it.
Right.
Or at least in the version we have from Adams, he calls it a tote-all. Then Arthur reveals that he remembered why he clutched the bag so tightly when he was sitting on the sofa, because something had changed.
Right.
And that, of course, is when Haktar had replaced the cricket ball or put the supernova bomb into Arthur's bag.
Correct.
So it did seem funny, and everybody was complaining about why Arthur's motivation was so strong to return to Lord's cricket ground. But of course, now in this scene, we understand that it was, again, part of the plot being driven forward by Haktar.
Right.
It's interesting. He again becomes the accidental hero.
Right. And that's actually where the book's story ends.
Right.
But there's a missing piece, so there has to be an epilogue.
Okay.
Epilogue. As the group traveled, they answered a distress call. The half-mad journalist they picked up told them of a trial he was covering. At this trial, a witness named Prak was being given a truth serum. White robots broke in to steal the Perspex Argabuthon Scepter of Justice. This caused the witness to receive much too much of the serum. When the witness was told to tell the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth, he did. The courtroom was evacuated and sealed. Using the infinite improbability drive, the Heart of Gold materialized inside the sealed courtroom. The group confronted Prak, who was finishing telling the truth. They all introduced themselves. When Prak heard the name Arthur Dent, he started laughing himself to death. After days of continuous laughter, Prak called for Arthur. Arthur asked him if he knew what the ultimate question was, to which the answer is 42. Prak told him that the question and the answer are mutually exclusive. It is impossible that both can ever be known about the same universe.
We know that the Golden Bale was the Heart of Gold, mm-hmm. Infinite Improbability Drive.
Right.
And we know that the Silver Bale was the Rory Award.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that the Steel Pillar was Marvin's leg.
Right.
And we know the Wooden Pillar was the burnt ashes in the trophy at Lord Cricket Ground, but they never told us where the Perspex pillar came from.
Right, right, right.
So they give us the epilogue that will explain where the Perspex pillar came from.
Right. Here is where we meet the final character of the book, Prax.
Yes.
And Prax has been given a drug to tell the truth and nothing but the truth.
Right.
And he's been given too much of this drug. And apparently this has caused an uproar in the courtroom. And as he's describing all these truths, everybody panics and leaves. And they determine that he's incurable and insane or whatever. And he has to be locked away inside a steel box.
Correct. Correct. And at that trial, the judge holds the Argabuthon Scepter of Justice, which is an ugly plastic thing. So that was the
yep.
Perspex pillar that the robots broke into and stole before the courtroom was evacuated and sealed.
That's right.
So the Infinite Improbability Drive gets the Heart of Gold to materialize inside the courtroom, but Prax was finished telling all of his truths, and he couldn't remember much of what he said, but the best parts involved frogs. So I thought that was funny.
Yeah.
And he only thought the best parts involved frogs because when they all introduced themselves, when he heard the name Arthur Dent, he literally laughed himself to death.
He did.
Yeah. But here's where we learn something very important.
Right. So here is where we learn this vital piece of information. Again, Prax says, I'm afraid, he said at last, that the question and the answer are mutually exclusive.
Right.
Knowledge of the one logically precludes knowledge of the other.
Right.
It is impossible that both can ever be known about the same universe.
Exactly.
If it happens, if it seems that the question and the answer would just cancel each other out and take the universe with them,
right.
Which would then be replaced by something even more bizarrely inexplicable, and it's possible that this has already happened.
Which is the last page of this book as the first page of the previous book. So I thought that was Nice bookends.
Yeah.
And then he does a little setup of what we can expect in the next book, which is where Arthur could find God's last message to his creation.
Right, right.
And then Prax dies.
I love the fact that Prax dies and he gets frustrated with Arthur because Arthur keeps saying, what was that? Where was that?
Yes. What was that? Yeah, he's trying to explain, giving directions, and he couldn't remember them all.
Oh, my gosh.
And then the last little bit that I wrote was what cracked me up, because if you can imagine it, Arthur kept flying for a while, and then he started to learn bird speak and was talking to the birds. But it was all just boring stuff about, you know, weight to lift ratios and aerodynamics that that he couldn't take it anymore. And then the one thing about bird speak is how much of it there is. So every time I hear birds chirping now, it's all just them talking back and forth about aerodynamics.
Oh, it's not about the wind speed of a sparrow, laden sparrow or unladen sparrow.
That's right. Unladen sparrow. Yes. What? I don't know that.
Oh, gosh.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, so we've come to the end. The next episode, we're going to break format a little bit. It's going to be about a book, but it's not going to be about the book that you think. We are going to do a novelization of a Doctor Who script that he wrote way back when that never got picked up. And he so liked the ideas that he had in that Doctor Who story that he used in Life, the Universe, and Everything. So we are going to read Doctor Who and the Cricket Men.
Wow, that's going to be different.
It will be.
I'm looking forward to it.
Yes, I can't wait. Mm-hmm. So, I think we're done, so say goodbye, Brian.
Okay, Jeff, make sure all your wickets stand tall.
Okay, I will. Thank you for listening to Digital Watches Are a Pretty Neat Idea. Look for us the first Thursday of every month for a full episode. We will also release a bonus episode later in the month. A very special thanks goes out to Luke, Max, Greg, and Tim Lesnick for arranging and performing our opening theme. We would also like to thank our talented friends and family for their voice work on our introductions and commercials. A special thank you this episode goes out to Robert Soa for stopping by with an insult. We would also like to thank Kelly Lesnick for doing our summary. Visit our website at digitalwatchesareapprettyneatidea.buzzsprout.com, where you can find links to all my Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy-inspired t-shirt designs. You can find us on Facebook and YouTube as Digital Watches Are a Pretty Neat Idea, on Instagram as Watches Idea Podcast, and on Twitter at Watches Idea. If you'd like to contact us, our email is digitalwatchespodcast@gmail.com.
This has been a Froods for Thought production.